This is Black Agenda Radio, a weekly hour of African American political thought and action.
Welcome to the radio magazine that brings you news, commentary, and analysis from a Black left perspective. I'm Glenn Ford, along with my co-host, Nellie Bailey. Coming up, Canada is best known to those of us who live south of its border as a place where everyone has access to single-payer health care. However, racism is killing disproportionate numbers of Black Canadians, just like in the U.S. And we'll talk with a talented artist and intellectual from Kenya, whose current project is using comic books to help African girls navigate the terrain of sex, health, and patriarchy. But first, Russiagate has consumed the U.S. corporate media for the past 2 years, but the no-collusion verdict of the Mueller investigation has caused the once superheated scandal to finally fizzle. In Philadelphia, Du Boisian scholar Anthony Montero says the implosion of Russiagate lays bare the deep crisis afflicting U.S. empire.
I think, first of all, Glenn, we have to look at this period going forward, that is for the next 2 years, as the post-Russiagate moment in the American political crisis. And that's what it is. The Mueller investigation was a part of a political crisis and an attempt to resolve a political crisis. And by political crisis, I mean a crisis of governance and crisis of rule. So therefore, when Mueller did not come back with what was expected by the dominant sections of the U.S. ruling class, it created a new stage of the crisis, and that is what we're living through. However, as you have mentioned, none of this occurs without a context. It is mediated. In other words, the internal domestic political crisis, and indeed chaos, is mediated by a crisis of U.S. empire. Now, that crisis is fueled by the, on the one side, the rise of China, and not just China rising as a military force or an economic force within the world, but for the first time, the United States faces, and world capitalism faces, an alternative economic model that is not just an alternative in the sense of economic theory and certainly economic practice, but an alternative which is technologically surpassing the West. And that is the meaning of 5G technology, the Chinese initiatives in artificial intelligence, in space research, and in robotics. So, in other words, we are looking going forward to a new dominant, maybe political system, but certainly economic model for the way that nations and the world will organize economic life. In terms of the Trump administration being hard on Russia, that's a relative term. I think that what we were looking at if had Hillary won the election is something really unimaginable. A color revolution, attempted color revolution in Russia, the trade war, so-called, with China is really negotiations about how to recouple the two economies. I think that the Trump administration, in the end, will have to retreat from its more aggressive position. China's position, not only in Asia, but now in Europe, with Italy indicating that it wants to join the Belt and Road Initiative that emanates from China, and of course, the growing relationships with at least 16 European nations, 11 of whom are members of the European Union. This is all very, very significant. And of course, we could mention the Russia-Chinese alliance, the Russia-China-Venezuela alliance. There's so much going on in the world which suggests that the old hegemon, the unipolar hegemon, the hegemon in the unipolar world, let me put it that way, of the United States, that is bygone history, and the political crisis domestically is a manifestation of the crisis of American empire.
There's little indication that Russiagate is over domestically in terms of the push to purge the left from the internet.
Well, yes. See, that's one of the consequences of the whole Russiagate thing. And this is why the left, as it defines itself, was so short-sighted in joining the whole anti-Trump movement, the idea that Trump represented the most dangerous presidency in the history of the United States and that he was a traitor and treasonous and on and on and on. And then when that did not get the types of responses among the people that the left expected, and here I'm not just talking about the Democratic Party as a left, but I'm talking about the left, social Democrats, and other leftists. When that didn't get the response, then they dropped the whole thing and went to other things. But I think the crisis of the liberal establishment, of the progressive, broadly defined, is also a crisis of the left. It is a crisis of understanding the current moment of crises of the Western system of capitalism and imperialism, and the left doesn't get it.
Well, certainly lots of folk who call themselves left speak just like rank imperialists when it comes to Venezuela and Syria and elsewhere in the world.
And Russia and China. Yes, and that's what they are. Too much of what is gone for, or what we accept as the left, is really not left. It is social imperialism. And let us be real, you cannot be left in the major imperialist country in the world, as King defined it, the major purveyor of violence in the world. You cannot be left without being anti-imperialist. And by being anti-imperialist, it means anti-imperialist war. And the left in the United States talks about everything but the fight against their own imperialism, as it were, or the struggle for peace and for détente and for the right of peaceful coexistence and for the right of self-determination of nations that have been oppressed by colonialism and imperialism historically.
You speak of the technological advances of China and also in terms of weaponry, those of Russia. How could the United States, which held the unquestioned lead in technology, it seemed like only yesterday, be falling behind?
Well, that's a good question. It's hard to answer. You know, I think, what is the Chinese model, economic model? Now, we can debate, is it capitalist or is it state capitalism hedged with conditions going over to socialism? In other words, is this a initial form of economic growth and development, the development of the productive forces and technology as a first step to going over to a 21st century form of socialism? I think that it is. How did China get the advantage in technology, especially this new computer and internet technology, and by implication, artificial intelligence and robotics? I think, first of all, the model where politics, and by that I mean the organization of governance, is not separated from economics. In other words, the productive forces and economic production. In other words, the people who govern the country politically are not separated from those who are engaged in the economy of the country. That means the contradictions that would normally occur and occurs, for instance, in our country between those who are at the helm or the commanding heights of the economy and those in government, you don't have that in the Chinese model. And it is very, it's a very appealing model. And it's being studied in places as far flung as Venezuela and India and Vietnam. And it is a way to make the transition from what we could call underdevelopment to an advanced form of socialist economic development. And that's what I see happening in the world. And that is what is driving the ruling classes of the West crazy. I don't care whether they're in England or in France, Italy, or Germany. They are going crazy because they have no answer to the problem of witnessing the West falling behind Asia, and Asia of a economic model that is the opposite of the so-called, and I put quotes, liberal model of social, economic, and political organization of society.
China has been a great polluter along with the United States, but has been moving ahead and is now seen as being in the lead in terms of green technologies. But the United States Senate and House show no sign of giving the okay to Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez's Green New Deal.
Yeah, well, because the economic model in the United States does not permit the solving of a great problem like climate warming. It can't do it. The model is not fit to do this. And so one can protest day and night about if we don't do something in 12 years, we'll be beyond repair and we're facing doom. But the question is not just to say that. The question is to put plausibly before the people what structural changes have to be made in the economic model in the United States. And I think that the Chinese economic model is best able to address profound human problems such as climate warming, and I would even suggest war and peace.
The Green New Deal, although it's only a resolution in Congress, a statement of intent, has caught fire in terms of the American public's imagination. Something like 90% of the American public say they're in favor, and that includes half of the Republicans.
That's interesting. I don't know exactly what that means. I think it's kind of like a pinata at the same time where the Republicans will beat it up going forward because of its lack of specificity. I think 90% of the American people are saying that they do want an answer to global warming. That's a given. The other thing is that we need to find out if the American people are as equally committed to a retreat from imperialist aggression and war, because you can't solve one without solving the other, as far as I'm concerned. And then the other thing is, are the American people able to understand the structural changes within the economy of the United States that would make it possible for this country, along with China and other countries, to resolve these problems of global warming and emissions that come from industrial production? Because it is, at the same time, it's not just a matter of the climate. It is a matter of jobs and the well-being of the people and, you know, kind of the immediate and the long-term or medium-term have to be synthesized and brought together in a reasonable program that people can identify with. At this point, we have nothing similar to that.
You speak of the contradictions and conflict within the U.S. ruling class, and that Russiagate is a product of that. But with Mueller's verdict of no collusion, those conflicts remain unresolved.
That's right. And these are not just conflicts in the ruling class. These are conflicts of the state itself. And this is something that is seldom looked at. What does it mean that the state itself, the main legitimate legal instrument of force and violence in society itself, is broken, is split, is in almost antagonistic contradiction with itself? What is the meaning of that? And where in history has this occurred before? Because it has occurred before. Often it leads, if it is combined, by the way, with an economic crisis, which is not out of the question in this current moment, it often leads to rebellion and revolutionary upsurges of the masses. This, I think, is what we are looking at, a broken state, a state in conflict with itself, and the onset of what could be a very, very severe economic recession / depression.
Bernie Sanders is making another run at the presidency. The corporate Democratic establishment could not countenance him in 2016, but he seems much stronger now.
And I think the operative word is seems. We don't know what's going to happen as almost 22 Democrats are running for the presidency, and each day another announces that she or he will announce soon and is exploring a run. We just don't know where all of this is going to lead. I think as much as anything, the crisis in the Democratic Party, something we talked about going back as far as 2016, this crisis in the Democratic Party could lead to the end of the Democratic Party itself. And what would come afterwards is very difficult to say. You know, I'm of the opinion, Glenn, that these differences among Democrats are not just policy differences, but they carry an existential character to them. In other words, the left, or what they call the far left within the Democratic Party, is not up for compromising with the centrist or corporate Democrats. And that means that each will eventually have to go their own way. We might see signs of that during the primaries and the debates that are going to unfold very soon.
And would that be a good thing?
For me, it would be a good thing. I think crisis, from the standpoint of radical change, is always a good thing. The question is, are there political forces able to take advantage of the crisis, to go among the people who will be looking for leadership and provide it? Is there a grassroots political movement that has ideas that could advance the cause of working people and the poor at this time? Part of the critique of the left is that it is a left which, and I put quotes, leads from above rather than from a position of organic relationships with the masses.
There were great hopes in 2014 and 2015 with the resurgence of what appeared to be a black movement. What's your assessment of that movement?
Well, a movement is not just a set of protests, but a movement is a sustained set of activities of masses of people, especially from the grassroots, with a leadership that emerges from the people. With the protests of Black Lives Matter, they were important protests. They drew attention to the question of police violence and murder. But I do not think a movement in the sense that I'm using it, in the classic sense of the civil rights movement, a movement emerged from that. And nor do I believe that a leadership, in the sense that I am speaking of leadership, emerged from the Black Lives Matter. So in some ways, we're back to square one. And we have to think about a movement, and I would say a movement of a new type. It will not be the civil rights movement of the 50s and 60s, but it will be something like that, demanding a new level of ideological clarity and a broader agenda than only civil rights. It will have to be economic justice and world peace, I think.
We went years in which there was no visible, autonomous Black voice in the peace movement. But now there's a Black Alliance for Peace.
Yes, and that's a very, very important development. Small, but it represents a vanguard. I would hope that the Black Alliance for Peace finds its way into communities such as in North Philadelphia. But certainly an alliance, a Black Alliance for Peace, will have to address all of the social problems confronting a community like North Philly or West Philadelphia, such as gentrification, such as joblessness, such as low wages and poverty. So an alliance for peace has to at the same time be an alliance against poverty. That's what I'm hoping for and looking forward to. But I'm very encouraged by the sisters and brothers who are doing the on-the-ground hard work in the Black Alliance for Peace.
That was Du Boisian scholar Anthony Montero speaking from Philadelphia. Eternity Martis is an award-winning Black journalist from Canada whose work focuses on issues of race and gender. She's author of a recent article on the health effects of anti-Black racism in Canada. Martis says Blacks in Toronto face a variety of health challenges directly related to race. However, when people in the United States think of Canada, if at all, it's often with admiration for their single-payer healthcare system.
Yeah, absolutely. Being north of the border, we think that things are very different here because we have a different history of racism than our friends in the south, up south across the border. But we actually, when you look at the studies, and I was shocked myself, one of the women mentioned in the story, she went to all these doctors in Toronto and in Scarborough, which is a very densely populated suburb full of people of color, including Black people. And she just found that she was treated so poorly. And a lot of research has actually shown that in the States, physicians have admitted to treating Black patients in less time, they see them less, they are more likely to misdiagnose them, they're more likely to see Black people as being more tolerant of pain or lying about pain. And in Canada, our physicians, they've done some studies. There was a 2012 report from the Wellesley Institute that found some evidence that Canadian physicians believe that they are immune to the kinds of racial biases exhibited by their colleagues in the U.S. But meanwhile, there have been studies in Canada as well from the patient side. Women's Health and Women's Hands, which runs healthcare services for Black women, for example, and also the Wellesley Institute have found that Black patients feel that they are being discriminated against by their Canadian physicians. So on one hand, you have Canadian physicians saying, well, that only happens with doctors in the U.S., but Canadian patients are saying, actually, you're treating me with discrimination when I access your services. So I think there's a huge gap here in the reality and the expectation of Canadian healthcare.
Yes, race is always on the agenda in the United States. We Black folks have made sure that it is. But it seems that in Canada, race is so under the table that, in fact, it has affected the ability of Canadians to collect data based on race in that country.
Yes, absolutely. So one of the big issues here, and in the story that I write about, is that racism can actually kill you. There are so many health effects that can happen mentally, physically. And in Canada, because we don't collect race-based data in the same ways that the U.S. and the U.K. and Australia does, we have no idea what folks here are going through and feeling when it comes to health and how race impacts health. And so the United Nations actually put out a study that looking at anti-Black racism in Canada, and the Ontario Human Rights Commission put out a report talking about anti-Black racism in policing in Toronto. And so there's a lot of racism going on here that we don't really talk about. We're seen as this very multicultural society, but actually people are dying or getting sick every day because of racism, because it's experiencing constant chronic discrimination. And some of those health effects include stress, anxiety, depression, suicide or suicidal thoughts, hypertension, especially for Black folks. But we just don't have the numbers here or the studies like in the U.S. and the U.K. So we're almost going off of what the U.S. reports are showing us about how racism affects mental and physical health.
And if folks don't know that these kinds of things, these actual presentation of diseases are symptomatic of racist treatment, then, well, doctors aren't going to be looking for them either.
Exactly. And I question what, as medical students or as doctors, learn while they're in medical school, because I think that what you learn about health is a very one-size-fits-all model. But the social determinants of health, which are the conditions in which people grow and work and live and age, they all play a role in the lives of Black folks and Black Canadians. And because Black Canadians are one of the most, if not the most, discriminated group in Canada, and in Canada, we are also, Black folks are also still the largest target of race-based hate crimes. All those things play a role in the deterioration of your health.
There have been a number of studies, however, about race and health in Canada. How come they're not catching on with the medical establishment?
I think that here in Canada, I would say that Black folks here and Black folks who are doing the research see racism and the health effects of racism as a public health crisis. And I don't think that multiple levels of government here have caught on in that way, in the same way that they would determine something else as a public health crisis. And so there are wonderful experts right now trying to collect race-based data across hospitals. We have forums talking about Black health in Canada. We have people doing this work, using the work that's been done in the U.S. on mental health and physical health and the effects of racism. But we don't actually have like a format or a solidified system on how to collect this data yet. And so on the ground, folks are like, you know, we need to consider this a public health crisis because folks are dying and folks are getting ill. But government has yet to step in and really see this as a big issue. They have committed $19 million over 5 years for mental wellness in Black communities. That's what the federal government has budgeted. But that's just not even a start. That's barely enough. And for the amount of health issues that folks are having and the prevalence of racism in Canada, that's barely enough to start addressing and researching and funding the issue.
Internally to the Black community, drawing the line between, let's say, police behavior and Black health should be an effective way of drawing together different groups within the community around the various issues, health and police brutality, and linking them in a common kind of struggle.
Absolutely. And as I said earlier, the Ontario Human Rights Commission did put out a report looking at the prevalence of anti-Black racism and police brutality against Black Torontonians and Black folks in Ontario. And so there are multiple groups right now being discriminated against by various institutions. And I think that with some funding and with some acknowledgement from the government of how we can put these groups together and have the people who are experiencing it and the people who are affected by these institutions come together and devise a plan, would be much more effective at reducing the harm that racism does to folks, as opposed to it being done by the government and saying, we're going to give you this amount of money to start an initiative. Let's get on the ground people who are experiencing police brutality, who are working in the police force, for example, who are working with youth affected by the criminal justice system. Let's get all of them on the same page and formulate a strategy.
Since Canada does have a healthcare system in which the government is much more involved, one would expect more results and quicker with a political approach to this problem.
Yes, yes. And I think, again, it's that racism has never been seen as a public health issue. And even Black folks who are in a ER are less likely to be scored high on a triage system. They wait longer in an ER. And so I think until we're able to see that this is a public health issue that doesn't just affect folks who experience racism, but folks who are victims of gun violence, mothers who die in childbirth, all of these factors that we need to start thinking about to get to a solution, we're not going to see any change even here in Canada.
And what's been the reaction of professional associations of doctors when they're told that as a group, they're acting callous to their Black patients, not even looking them in the eye, as has been reported?
Yes, so that's a big thing, not even looking them in the eye, not answering questions. I think, again, we are so focused still on the behavior of and the research on doctors in the U.S. that here this is almost denial, that that doesn't happen, that doctors here are colorblind. We don't treat our patients like that. But we're hearing from patients, as including some of the people in the story that I wrote, that that's not the case. They're being pushed out of emergency rooms or waiting long times. They're being pushed out of the doctor's office. I myself have gone in to get services by healthcare providers and have not been looked in the eye or been very quickly dismissed. And I think the issue is not that it's not happening in Canada, which doctors seem to not get, but it's that because the U.S. is so ahead in terms of research, it looks as if the doctors in the U.S. are, in fact, are racist. But here, there's inherent racial bias in our healthcare system. There's inherent racial bias in all of us. So to think that it wouldn't continue into your practice as a healthcare provider is just a denial and is dismissive of the reality.
So it's not that these doctors are colorblind, but they're blind to the presentation of signals of ill health.
Absolutely, especially with Black folks. They're blind to, you know, for example, one of the women that I interview has endometriosis, which is a reproductive condition that affects 1 in 10 women, but significantly affects Black women. That diagnosis alone takes 10 years. And so they're blind to not only the issues that Black folks face, Black and brown people face a disproportionate rate, but they're also blind to how racism, again, can exaggerate or worsen the conditions they already have. And again, we won't know that because we don't have the race-based data. We just have folks saying these are their experiences, but doctors like to see facts and they like to see data and they want to see those numbers, but we just don't have them to give. Racism itself is a chronic stressor, and for years we've known this. And over time, when you experience discrimination or microaggression or structural racism daily, hourly, by the minute, that there's no way that that couldn't weigh on your mental health and your physical health. And I think it's something we need to start taking very seriously, that it is itself a chronic stressor that Black folks experience daily in multiple ways. Economically, socially, politically, it's there and we need to start paying attention to that.
That was journalist Eternity Martis in Toronto, Canada. Thousands of young girls in Kenya are illuminating their own lives through the lens of comic books. Anne Marat is a writer, editor, and performer who's dedicated to telling compelling stories through an African feminist lens. For the last 5 years, she's been developing comics and magazines targeting girls in her East African country.
Comics had been a really, really effective storytelling method because it gives a combination of abstraction and realism. Abstraction meaning that you don't have to literally look at yourself. When you're talking about a really difficult subject, particularly for younger people, it can be very difficult to see an image of a girl saying, for example, that she was harassed. And it's an actual girl actually speaking, can be fairly triggering. And a comic allows you to kind of dive into these difficult subjects, so this kind of abstracted image that exists. But then it's also really realistic because we spent a lot of time working with girls, developing it way before the first draft, trying to understand with my illustrator, Nadia Adhiambo, on what does a Black girl actually look like? What does her hair look like? What does a Black girl in Kenya actually look like? What shape are they? What size are they? What are the different variations? So when you look at the comic, in as much as it's a cartoon, you still see yourself. The second part of it is that before we decided on the comic books, we're inspired, or the company was inspired by a very effective comic book that exists called Shujaz. which the illustrator of Aradhana Comics worked with before. And they had a circulation of, I'm looking at some statistics, in 2015, they reached 2 million comics. And I think at some point they were circulating, the monthly circulation was more than Spider-Man in the States, for example. I can't confirm that exact figure, but it was a really, really high circulation rate. And they'd already kind of proven out that comics were a really effective tool for behavior change because you provide really clear information in the language that the people speak, Sheng, and in a really simple, understandable format that's very compelling because you have a narrative through it. And the final thing is the magazine at large started with the idea of a single comic. The idea was to have a one-pager comic that could be inside a pad package. But because we constantly asked girls, what is it that you want? What is it that you need? It grew into a 12-page comic, which grew into a 12-page one-story comic instead of 12 different stories, which became a 52-page magazine featuring both stories of real people, activities with specific information, kind of infographics, and the comic book itself. So a whole universe of Nia comics. And the combination of the three became really deeply effective, but the comic's specialty was narrative. There's a way a comic can tell a story that a really amazing and powerful feature of a real person can't, because it demands the reader to enter the story in the way great fiction does overall.
Do the girls realize that the comic is partly a socio-political tool, and do they mind?
I don't know if they'd say the word socio-political, but the comic did come from questions they asked. Susanna, at the time, I think, had over 10,000 questions gathered from girls anonymously. And so we knew the kind of questions they wanted answered. And when the girls were reading it, they were looking for answers as well. When I would witness girls read it, they would see like, oh, I don't like how this girl is treating Nia badly, and I don't like how they laughed at this girl because of her period, and I wouldn't do that to my friends, and we shouldn't do that for our friends, and it would spark conversation. I don't want to say that they thought it was a socio-political tool. I think that's a grand ask for any 10-year-old, but they did know it was an educational comic, and they were seeking education in it. They wanted to know information, and I think it made it more compelling for them because especially over time, they realized that this comic was answering questions that they had. And so it made them want to read it more.
Nia Teen Magazine is a project of Zena Africa, which is also engaged in lots of other activities, including work with girls' menstrual pads.
Yes, so Zena Africa was started by Megan Mukuria, I believe, 10 or more years ago. And she'd been living here for a long time and realized that sanitary towels and just access to menstrual hygiene products is a massive, massive issue. And so she began work on that, and it expanded into sanitary pad provision and expanded into training partners. And she realized that, oh, even if you give them these pads and education, these pads and panties, it still doesn't answer the questions they have, that they lack opportunities to talk to people in, let me say, pre-colonial and traditional cultures here in Kenya, there were systems in place to kind of guide girls and any child really to the puberty process. But the colonization process broke a lot of those structures, and a lot of the work ended up with schools and with teachers. And we have a fairly conservative society, so it was difficult for our education system to cater for sensitive subjects like sex, like periods, like UTIs, for example. So that's when the idea of developing educational products came in. So I joined the organization with the illustrator when the idea of the educational products came in to make these comics. And so currently what's going on is there's a large-scale randomized control trial trying to understand what is the impact of pad provision and sexual health education on girls. What are the outcomes? How does it affect their confidence? How does it affect their educational outcomes? It's still ongoing. I believe the results will be coming out in 2020. And it's targeting, I think it's between 7,000 and 10,000 girls in this randomized control trial overall. And I think about 2,000 of them are receiving the magazines. So it'll be really interesting to see the full outcome of giving girls the information they want, plus the resources they need.
And how are the ideas and the answers that are developed from these surveys and emanating from the magazine, how are they going to be diffused throughout society?
I think the organization is working through that. Currently not with the organization anymore, but I know they're putting and are putting in a lot of thought into the next phase of it. There has been a lot of training of partners, and any partner organizations who receive PAD provision do get training on what girls need and require. And ultimately, I think having a research study that proves out the need of this education is a method to get the funding, the resources, the government backing internationally that ensures that this education happens. And there's a model that's been developed by us. So there's a NIA curriculum that exists. The magazine has content that I believe one of our heads brought to the States, I think, maybe to Brooklyn, I'm not sure where, and found girls there who lack this information. So the fundamental information exists. There's a model that exists. There's a curriculum that exists. It's supported by other curriculums that have existed from other organizations. So in terms of wider dissemination, it really just depends on organizations and bodies which have funding and governments which can implement larger policies, realizing the need for it and putting the resources behind it. The moment that happens, I don't think it's an impossible ask to spread the information around, not just Kenya, but the world.
And of course, the issue of sexual abuse of girls is a critical one, not just for the people directly involved, but it's all about power issues in society as well.
Yes.
That is, girls are vulnerable in societies to sexual abuse because of the power relationships. Who is vulnerable and who can complain?
Yeah, that is very true. And I think this is deeply universal anyway. I mean, it's consequences of the patriarchal world we live in. There's so many girls and women who either do not have a safe space in which to communicate what has happened to them, know that even if they do communicate what's happened to them, nothing is going to happen. At best or at worst, they're going to be demonized and potentially even criminalized for saying so. And lastly, completely understandably, they may not be able to express what's happened. They may need to not speak it out loud for a time until they're ready to say so. So there's a massive power question, and it's a huge systemic issue that even when we were writing content on reporting and on communicating what's going on with you, it was a really difficult ask. It's very difficult to tell a girl, report everything, and also know that the police isn't going to respond to you the way that you need to respond. So yeah, there's a really, really big power question. The only thing I think we were able to tell them was we did encourage reporting, of course, and we laid out systems and we worked with the organizations here, which have, this is what happens when you report, this is what happens when you go to the police station, this is what should happen when you go to trial. But we really try to center it around the girls themselves. And I'd say this to myself, to anyone I know, woman or girl, that being able to speak out, even if it's just to a friend, and to name this thing that happened to you that was terrible, it's really rooted for you. And if you choose not to, that's fine. And if you choose to, that's also fine. And you can't help what the world does back, but you can help what you do for yourself. That's really the heart of what we're trying to say, and actually the heart of all the work, that ultimately the power structures are in place that really try to take you down in so many different ways, but you are still a full person and you deserve the full support and care that isn't being given to you. And you can give that as much as you can to yourself and as much as you can surround yourself with people who give you that support.
You write for a feature comic called Nia that's about a young girl in Kenya, and you use that character and the stories in order to get girls to open up about how they interact with boys, with each other, with society at large.
Yeah, so I wrote that. I worked at Zan Africa for about 5 years, and I always said that I wrote it for myself. I was and I am that 12-year-old girl. I grew up here in Kenya. I know what it feels like to be in this space. So very selfishly, like with all my writing, even since I've left Zana and I'm doing fiction and plays and so on, it always starts with what I'm interested in hearing about and what I'm interested in reading. And when I started working with Zana, it was ultimately like, what would 12-year-old me want? Because I knew I needed information about sex. I wanted information about boys and not just boys and relationships in general. I wanted information about my friendships. I wanted information about careers. I needed to know all these things. So writing a comic that helps girls like me, girls who are me, was so deeply gratifying. And my favorite feeling in the world was when a girl read the comic and kind of started criticizing it. And I was like, why is her hair like that? Or what is she doing? Because it just made me see, when you don't criticize something in that way unless you feel a connection. And when they're like, I don't like that girl because she was mean to the other one, because she was bullying her, I'm like, yes, thank you. Because you're having a deeply emotive response to a story that you're connecting with. It was such a beautiful and powerful experience that I'm deeply, deeply grateful to have gone through.
Here in the United States, we're used to tweens and lots of kids younger than that having created social lives that are totally digital. But here you're using a comic book. Are comic books part of the daily lives of lots of young people in Kenya?
There's a couple of points to that. So first of all, Kenya has very high mobile penetration and internet penetration, but in lower income areas, and particularly girls from lower income areas, access to those phones and access to technology is very difficult. We did a fair amount of research because we were thinking of developing an SMS platform, and it turns out that parents wouldn't give phones to girls because they believed it was access to all this pornography and to all this horrible information, which, I mean, I'm not one to speak to anyone's parenting, but they didn't have access to the technology that a lot of either more upper class girls do within Kenya and I guess the continent, as well as what I imagine is happening in the States. So it needed to be a medium on paper. When it comes to if comics are really widely circulated, newspapers have very high circulation here. Shujaz was distributed to newspapers, which is one of the reasons it had very high circulation. Zana Africa's model was distributing through schools. So we printed and published the magazines ourselves and then went working with schools, distributed to girls aged 10 to 14, so a certain class from standard 6 to standard 8 in primary school. So that was our particular model. In terms of other comics, I can't really speak to that.
You said that there is a reluctance to give phones to girls because that would expose them to bad influences. But that has vast ramifications in terms of the socialization and education of females.
Well, there's a double side to it. So I'm speaking very specifically about lower income areas where, for example, a household might have one phone, which, again, the patriarchy is likely to be the father's. And so there is an access question. If a household does not have access to phones to begin with or to technology to begin with, even electricity, there's a wider kind of systemic social question of we need to give people access to resources and tools. The other side of it, which is, I get what you're pulling at, is the lack of access to tech can hinder what girls and women can do with that information and how they can access information that's more relevant to them. So again, what I was kind of trying to pull at my essay is I don't want to be too presumptive that the lack of tech therefore causes giant block to girls. I think a bigger question comes around what exactly are girls learning? Who exactly are they learning it from? And who exactly should we use or access in order for girls to get the information they need? If you have a phone and data and a Wi-Fi plan, but you've not received any information from anyone around what healthy sex is, it is reasonable to expect that you might get misinfluenced. I've read essays from the States about how young girls are engaging in sexual acts they do not enjoy, that they don't fully consent to, but they believe that this is what you should do in sex. And because the young boys also believe the same thing. Again, I'm not saying they should not get access. I 100% believe that everybody in Kenya, in the world, should have equal access to technology. I just don't want to conflate the two questions of technology and general education and information.
Yes, what you're saying is that we also must be taking a feminist or female liberationist approach to the whole subject of technology and all the other subjects in society.
Exactly. Yes. It's not enough to say giving access equals information. It is deeply important to consider what information is out there and who has been given it and how can we not determine what information people access, but how can we give people the tools and the resources they need in order to get the information they want? How can we train them in learning, discerning what is true, what isn't? How can we equip them when they're still very young with the true knowledge about sex and sexuality and gender and wider feminist principles that people have been working on for decades? Like, it's deeply important to start there. Often, particularly on an international perspective, it is very easy to look at young girls and young African girls, young, poorer African girls, and think they do not have minds of their own, that they don't know what they need, that it is as simple as, oh, girls need pads because they become more effective economic producers. They need sexual health education because it reduces their sexual debut. And it's a worldview that I really dislike. It's deeply important for everyone to know that if you want to talk to anyone, however young, wherever they're from, whatever their needs are, you have to ask them. It has to be rooted in their needs, not your perspective of their needs, but what they are telling you. It doesn't mean you don't apply your knowledge or your skills or your expertise to discern specifics. It doesn't mean that you ignore the larger systems at play that might make somebody misname or not recognize a need that they do have. But if the presumption is that you are smarter or you know better than the people on the ground living their lives, no one knows more about their life than the person living it. No one knows more about girlhood than a girl. And if you can't center them in everything that you do, and I do this now even with my work outside of Zana, if I'm writing about a character, if I'm writing about a person, I cannot assume that I know. It has to be centered in the people that I believe I'm speaking to or from or about, always. So for anyone who's listening and wants to work, come to Africa, quote, or support African girls, quote, though I hate those phrasings. If you want to do any kind of work supporting people here, your number one job is listening to them. Number one. Everything else comes second. And if you don't listen to them, there's nothing you're doing of value, in my mind. There's literally nothing you're adding to the conversation that hasn't been said.
That was Anne Murrah, a writer and performer in Kenya, East Africa. Stevie Stevenson is serving a long prison term in California. He says the California Department of Corrections is putting law books out of the reach of incarcerated people. Stevenson files this report for Prison Radio.
In 1966, over 100 inmates filed a civil lawsuit against CDC for not having law books in the system. The name of the case was called Gilmore versus Lynch, 319 Fed Sup at page 105. The outcome of the lawsuit ended with an injunction that allowed inmates in CDC to have law books to learn about the law, whether it was to help them on a direct appeal, a writ of habeas corpus, or to fight prison conditions. This injunction was in place for 30 years, from 1966 until 1996. In 1996, a case called Lewis versus Casey, 518 U.S. 343, 1996, came out. In that case, the United States Supreme Court, led by Justice Rehnquist, decided that inmates were not allowed law libraries. In doing so, CDC stopped the order of law books. However, due to the Gilmore injunction, the case that started in 1996, they couldn't take the law books away. Long story short is, in 2010, the Department of Corrections convinced the attorneys who were the lawyers over the injunction to keep law books in CDC, convinced them that they were going to put the law books in their Title 15. So what CDC did was they regulated the law books, which were published by Westlaw. Once they did that, the prison law office signed off the long-time injunction. Once the injunction was no more and CDC had total control of the law books in 2010 without receiving any approval from what is called the Administrative Procedures Act or through the Office of Administrative Law, CDC changed the law books, ridded them, and gave a whole new system under Lexis. and how this has affected many men, women, and juveniles incarcerated because they don't have an easy system to learn the law. For the past 3 or 4 years, this California legislator has worked very hard to make new laws, to pass new laws, and what has happened is without the law books, they don't understand how to use those law books and everything like that. So if they're passing new laws, then CDC has taken away the law books that teaches people how to learn the law.
And that's it for this edition of Black Agenda Radio. Be sure to visit us at blackagendareport.com, where you will find a new and provocative issue each Wednesday. That's www.blackagendareport.com. It's the place for news, commentary, and analysis from the Black left. I'm Nellie Bailey, along with my co-host Glenn Ford. Our thanks to the good people at the Progressive Radio Network. We'll be right back.